Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap?
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise? The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now then, we have Chelsea against Real Madrid this evening. Obviously, PSG dumped out last night at the hands of Man City. Philippe Auclair is with us. Hello.
Good evening to you.
Can I start somewhere slightly unusual? So Chelsea, Real Madrid this evening. Karim Benzema is on 71 Champions League goals. He can overtake Raul and go outright fourth in history this evening. Mm-hmm. Relatively recent history, of course, given the extra number of games these days. But still, that's a hell of achievement. I noticed Arsene Wenger was calling for his return to France's Euro 2020 squad. He referred to the non-sport problem. This, just to remind the listeners, has been dragging on for a long time. So Karim Benzema is going to face trial in October for his alleged involvement in an attempt to blackmail his former teammate, France teammate, Mathieu Valbuena, in a sex tape scandal. So he was banned.
Mathieu Valbuena, who was also taken out of the French team. It should always be added.
Yes.
Yes. It really is. That's one of the reasons why I say it.
Oh, Valbuena, yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, he was also taken out of the team.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So banned from the national team since 2015. I think the Prime Minister at the time came out and said he shouldn't have anything to do with the team. The investigators have charged Benzema. They believe, and he denies it, he was approached by a childhood friend that year to act as intermediary and convince Valbuena to deal directly with the blackmailers. Instead, Valbuena went straight to police. Benzema's lawyers has called this all absurd. Benzema says he's innocent. This six-year saga has been a masquerade. And Arsene Wenger is saying he should be reinstated to the French squad ahead of the trial in October. What's your take on all this? Is there a growing call in France for Benzema's reinstation?
Thank you very much for this
Sorry.
Wonderful introduction to the program.
It's Wenger's
really
fault.
The easiest thing to deal with. There's one thing you should never forget about the Benzema affair. And when it comes to merit, I do think that Karim Benzema is one of the greatest French players of all time. I would put him very, very high in this list, in the top four, without a doubt, for me. What you have to remember is that the person who decides who gets in the French team or not is Didier Deschamps. And I don't really want to take sides here because it is a poisoned debate in France. It's horrible. It's genuinely horrible. But one thing I want to say is people should remember, before they start to jump to conclusions, that when Didier Deschamps decided that he should keep Karim Benzema and Mathieu Valbuena out of the French team when the story became public, he received death threats. He had to be put under police protection. His family was subjected to death threats. So if you know a bit Didier Deschamps, I don't think you will forget that. Mm. Nothing to do, of course, Karim Benzema is not responsible for that. Some people who think they were defending Karim's case did that. And I think the consequences are still here. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, to be honest, because it's true that France could do with Karim Benzema. Could do with one of the greatest, perhaps the greatest pure number nine France has ever had, with Just Fontaine. And I don't know where to go here, because I have so much respect for Karim Benzema, the player, and actually for the man as well, because he hasn't done whatever he's done, as you know, as far as the Valbuena affair is concerned. It is up for the courts to decide, not up to you, not up to me or public opinion. You know, on the pitch, he's been absolutely immense, and he's probably one of the most underrated players in world football because of that. On merit, it's not that he deserves this place in the French team. he ought to have this place in the French team. But something is broken between the national team manager and Karim Benzema, something that nothing will ever repair. Didier Deschamps is not somebody who forgets a grudge easily. And it's very sad. I wouldn't say it's tragic, but it is extremely sad that we see a team that has won so much in the recent past could have won it as well with Karim Benzema, and I think they could have done that. So I've probably skirted the question, because it is one which is, you know, we would need a couple of hours to discuss it properly, because there are so many levels straight up to this, it's not a debate, to this quarrel, which go across racial lines, identity lines, political lines, and with an awful lot of hypocrisy thrown in. So it's not something that I feel very comfortable talking about, further than what, you know, I've just said, which I hope was clear enough.
No, it was perfectly clear. And really, I was just curious to see if Wenger was in some kind of majority here. But you've cleared that up, given the Deschamps stance.
He only thinks about football. And he's able to do this. He's in Zurich at the moment. That's fine. He's with Gianni. I think he's cut himself from this kind. I think it's a little bit. I would love to see what Arsène's attitude would be if he'd been in the position that Didier Deschamps found himself in when the whole scandal happened. I mean, I have to say that because of this, Deschamps has been accused of being a racist, for example, in France. He's been accused of not taking players in the team who have got Maghrebi origins or heritage, and which is of course rubbish, because Wissam Ben Yedder, for example, is in the French team regularly. But it is noxious, it is toxic, it is horrible, and it's an important thing to talk about, because it shows the fault lines in French society beyond the football problem, and what is probably the most most fragile, the most sensitive side and the nodal point of French contradictions when it comes to national identity and the way that France is living with its post-imperial legacy, and the relationship in particular with people who come from North Africa. It's absolutely essential to understand that. But it's something that I'm writing a book about, and I'm trying to, and something which is very difficult to circumscribe within, you know, a few minutes on the radio or on the podcast. Is very, very difficult.
I can imagine.
Again, my apologies if what I say is hinting at things rather than explaining them.
No, that's okay. I'd love to get your thoughts on it some evening, on a quiet evening, and tease it out and hand you over the floor. So, because you are here to look ahead to Chelsea Real Madrid ostensibly, but we try and approach these things in a more interesting manner than who's going to win the game always. Can I then, a shift in theme, but I want to talk Zidane. To what extent does he move beyond racial lines, I don't know. But your colleague, Julien Lorraine, was on BBC, for instance, and he was talking about the lack of appreciation of Zidane, and he was saying things like, you know, Cancelo plays from fullback to inside midfielder. People say it's genius from Guardiola. When Mendy does a similar thing for Madrid, no one says Zidane was good. And he was just underlining the extent of Zidane's CV. 3 Champions Leagues, 2 La Ligas. He has won 13 of his 14 European knockout ties, which is quite extraordinary. If he wins this evening, only Alex Ferguson, Ancelotti and Lippi have reached 4 finals. Zidane would become the 4th. So that would be quite an extraordinary achievement. And yet, you ask anybody to name the best 3, 4, 5, 6. I don't know how far down the list you'd have to go. Best coaches in the world. Zidane doesn't trip off the tongue.
No, it doesn't. It's crazy, isn't it? It has to do perhaps with the way that we think about what is a manager, or what a manager should be, and how a manager should present himself. Zidane is not a tactical genius or a tactical innovator like Guardiola has been, like Marcelo Bielsa is, like you could carry on, like Ralf Rangnick is, or Jürgen Klopp, quite a few people, maybe even Ralf Hasenhüttl. He's not one of these people who devises new tactical systems, but he's one thing, he's somebody who is capable of making these crazy club and this crazy team win trophies. Mm. And not everybody can do that. So an element of it is the fact that most people detest Real Madrid. Let's be absolutely honest about that. And so therefore, when you're associated with this club as a player, then as a manager, and you win, and sometimes you win in circumstances like, for example, the win over Liverpool, that still sticks in the throat, I think, for many people, you know, Sergio Ramos and all that. It's a bit of a problem, but I think that it's also that we've grown to think of managers as people who have got those great scientists, those super brains, who somehow have a means to solve all problems, when the most important thing for them is man management. And there's absolutely no doubt that in this particular domain, Zidane is absolutely fantastic with that kind of club. And this is where you have reservations, because you think, would he realize the same things if he were with a lesser club? Perhaps not, because he uses the authority he has as one of the greatest players ever to wear the Real Madrid shirt. Mm. He uses his natural authority as well as a man, and his past and his achievements as a means to pacify this most rebellious of and difficult to manage dressing rooms. And when you do that and you achieve the results that he has, of course you've got to be ranked amongst the great managers, but you will not be ranked against the great theoreticians of the game. Mm. You will not. Mm. Because he's not that kind of manager. He's good at coaching. Like, some of his substitutions can be very inspired at times. He's obviously not that stupid in terms of the way he organizes his team, otherwise I don't think we would have seen the results we've seen in the past few years. But he's not an innovator. He's not somebody as well who presents himself as a great manager. And that plays against him.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair answer. And we'll see how he goes this evening against Tuchel, who is doing a good job. Before
manager that people think is superior to Zinedine Zidane.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Before you go, PSG last night then. So it's all in tatters. They're well, they've three games to go in Ligue 1. They're a point behind Lille, yes, which is very interesting. So can Lille hang on for three games is a big question mark. In which case, if they do, suddenly it's a really disastrous season for Pochettino. It all became very petulant and fell to pieces really last night for PSG after a brilliant first 45 minutes in this tie.
Yes.
I mean in the first leg, not last night, by the way.
Well, last night I thought the first 45 minutes were very good, actually, from PSG. But yes, unfortunately for PSG, it's the same drawbacks and defects which have come across and come through. And you saw the complete loss of discipline. I think they could have finished with eight men, really, on the pitch. I think Verratti should have been sent off, for example. And there were a number of other incidents as well, which were really quite worrying. And you could see Pochettino looking at it from the touchline, thinking, you know, what can I do? Mm. I've often said, I think I've said it to you in the past, I think that PSG is in need of a psychiatrist as much as it is in need of a manager. They've had some wonderful managers. Carlo Ancelotti was a marvelous manager. Laurent Blanc and Jean-Louis Gasset were not a bad team at all. Unai Emery, whatever people say and make jokes about his English accent, was not a bad manager. And you can, Thomas Tuchel is certainly not a bad manager. Isn't he showing it at the moment? Mm. And we all know Mauricio Pochettino is a wonderful manager. So there is a prime which goes beyond that, and which is linked to the way this club has been structured ever since the 2011 takeover by the Qataris. And it is. And one of the comments I saw in most French papers today, which was correct, was Manchester City, which is a club which has many things in common with PSG, notably in terms of ownership, showed that football is first and foremost a collective, not an individual game. But the thing is, PSG has been behaving as if it were an individual game for so long now. And unfortunately, you saw that again last night. One of the big individuals was out, Kylian Mbappé. The other was on and off, alternative current. He showed some good things. He showed some very poor things. Neymar, of course. And the club doesn't seem to be able to go over that, to go beyond this collection of individuals which, by the way, have a really, you know, I mean, the difference in level of these players, you know, between a Neymar and a Diallo, for example, or a Paredes and an Mbappe, or a Di Maria, a good Di Maria, and quite a few other players, actually, Bacca, for example, is so striking. So it's this back to the drawing board for them, which is extraordinary, because they've actually, after being in the final just a few months ago, they went to the semi-final after beating FC Barcelona and Bayern Munich, which is something that in itself is absolutely remarkable. It's the best performances they've had in Europe ever. But despite that, there is such an anticipation from the fans, from the board, from everybody, from the media in France, that they should be winning it, that you have got this quite extraordinary reaction. And what Marcel Pochettino is making of it, I have no idea, but I'm sure he's discovering things that he thought he already knew. But no, you're really in a madhouse, Mauricio.
Yes, I would say he's learning all sorts of things. Philippe, we'll see who joins Man City in the final this evening. Enjoy Real Madrid against Chelsea. Thanks so much.
Sure, I will. Thank you very much.
Philippe Auclair there with us, our football coverage and Off the Ball. But thanks to Paddy Power for information on responsible gambling. Visit gamblingcare.ie. We will, after 8 o'clock, be joined by Chris Jones. He's the BBC's rugby correspondent, and Matt Williams as well. Lions squad, 36-man squad being named tomorrow.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Okay, busy football show. Second half about to get underway at Stamford Bridge. Real Madrid are coming out. Sergio Ramos leading the team. They are 1-0 down. Timo Werner with a goal on 28 minutes. Brilliant play from Kante in the build-up. He won the ball in midfield, played Kai Havertz through, who dinked the ball off the crossbar, and Timo headed in. He was not going to miss this. This was from about a yard out. He had been caught offside earlier for a goal he'd scored. Really, it was bad play on his part. Glenn Hoddle and Stephen McManaman on commentary both in agreement. He was looking across the line. Chilwell was about to square the ball, and Timo, probably, I would suspect, because he's so anxious and so lacking in confidence maybe at the moment, wanted to make sure he was going to win the race to get to the ball. So he never dropped back into an onside position, stayed offside, and offside was given. It was a poor play, really, at that level. But he's got his goal. Chelsea are in the ascendancy at the moment, and we'll see how things go. Real Madrid playing pretty well, having a lot of the ball, but Chelsea probably looking the more threatening to join Man City May 29th in Istanbul. So that's where we are. Dan McDonald of the Irish Independence with us. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Joe.
I know you're probably covering the situation at Waterford, which we'll come to. So I don't know, have you had a chance to watch much of the game at Stamford Bridge?
Yeah, like that did actually break our ice sort of during the game. So yeah, a bit of half and half, to be honest. I did see the major chances, but yeah, not on the level you would expect, but such is life.
Any thoughts on what you did see?
Yeah, I mean, I probably caught more of the halftime analysis, and it was interesting actually just watching Brian Kerr and Virgin talking about Zidane, maybe tactically, where he might have got some things wrong, particularly they're struggling down their right side, and even playing Vinicius on the right side, almost at times, like, you know, he's had some defensive work to do as much as anything, when he's normally sort of pressed on attacking on the other side, and just questioning that. I mean, obviously this is a consequence of Hazard coming into the equation and a bit of a rejig there, and obviously suggesting that they've made some mistakes. And I suppose the flip side of the argument is if Mendy doesn't make a couple of good saves, you know, you're having a different discussion. And it is one of those things with the away goal, where one Madrid goal early would have put them so far in the box seat. You know, you would imagine they would almost have finished it off, whereas now they're sort of caught in a situation where they have to go and ask the questions of Chelsea, and Chelsea maybe, even for all that Werner's low on confidence, I mean, he's obviously very quick, and if you have a situation where the other team is chasing the game, you can see why Chelsea could have moments on the counter-attack, and they've actually, not from a counter-attack, from a decent attack, they just hit the bar there with a Havertz with a header. So, it is one of those, though. At least it's a close enough game that there comes a point with Madrid that they really have to go all out. And that obviously makes for an entertaining game.
Man City already through, as we know. Comfortable winners last night in the end against PSG. 2-0 on the night, 3-1 on aggregate. Neymar grabbed the attention of L'Equipe. They gave him 3 out of 10. What an astonishing waste from the first minutes, they said. They lamented his constant moans to the referee, claimed that he was, quote, crushed by the load put upon him. And then France Football decided, well, L'Equipe can't be the ones who grab all the headlines for tough reviews. So they said, was it really necessary for Neymar to take 6 touches every time he's on the ball? Neymar revealed his dark side against Manchester City, wanted to do everything on his own. The centre of the world in his own eyes. He disgusted his own teammates by serving them much too rarely. This does feel like a Google Translate job, I must admit. But anyway, the centre of the world in his own eyes. He disgusted his teammates by serving them much too rarely. Carried away by his emotions again, Neymar was catastrophic. So that was the verdict over in France. The Icardi was the only player to get a lower mark than Neymar by L'Equipe. 2 out of 10. They called him a total disaster. They cited Icardi's 13 miserable touches in the first half and none in the final 20 metres of the pitch. So 2 out of 10 for Icardi. Highest marks went to Riyad Mahrez, both goals, 8 out of 10, fair enough. And of course, Phil Foden, who again underlined what a superstar this guy's going to be, 7 out of 10.
I thought L'Equipe are normally quite stingy with their marks. I was going to say 3 out of 10 is possibly, you know, middle of the peloton, like, you know, in terms of some of their ratings sometimes. But they're throwing out 8s there, so maybe not. I don't know. Like, I mean, there was a sort of couple of moments towards the end, all right, where Neymar really overplayed it a few times. But it's another one of those ones as well, where the higher profile the player is, the more likely they are to become a scapegoat when a team loses, which is obviously... You know, that's why he's paid more than everyone else too. You know, that's part that goes with the territory. But obviously, you know, PSG's maybe lack of quality in certain areas overall is probably, you know, as much to do with the outcome as any particular deficiencies of Neymar.
What did you make of the game?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I was enjoying your interview with the Taoiseach. So I was sort of the first half. I was all pictures and no sound. But I mean, ultimately, like, City, after they overcame that early wobble, which is always at these second legs in the Champions, these big Champions League games, when you have a team with an advantage, you sort of feel like the away side, as much as there's no fans and everything, like, they have to do something early, really, in a way. And there was that early flurry of activity. There was that penalty that was chalked off, and 2 or 3 other chances in that period, and you're thinking, yes, you can completely rip up the script if you do something here now. And once they didn't do that, City just got control of the situation, and it was like, nah, we're fine here. And the better side came through from that point. And it's a lot of the discussions we've probably had about City at various times before. Again, it's like the depth of options that they have, it's the quality they have. It's like Mahrez has really actually become probably a sort of a premium level player for them this year in some degree. And Foden obviously has too. Whereas maybe last year in that type of game, I mean, who would have been playing? Like, it might have been Sterling. It might have been, Silva could have been pressed on, or, you know, like, depending on the situation with Jesus or Aguero or whatever. And like, it's like a rotating sort of cast of characters that they have there. But they're all very, very good. And that quality really ultimately just shone through in the end. I don't think you could ever, I don't think, yes, there was moments in the tie where it could have gone in either direction, but I don't think you could say it was a miscarriage of justice. I mean, I suppose the one thing is, if Mbappe had been fit for last night, that probably took away something from the game, that he wasn't there. I think that was a bit of luck that he wasn't present.
Yeah. I only saw highlights, really, but at times it's really striking how committed City are without the ball these days. You know, there were moments where Diaz, you know, dies with his head to stop a shot come cross, and there's another point where Neymar is kind of dribbling across the penalty area and Stones and Zinchenko both make kind of a brilliant joint block, and numerous times they just got a leg to a ball or a head to a ball or got a tackle in or made a foul, and they are more than adept at tactical fouling and quite happy to sit in a 4-5-1 when required without the ball as well. Like, there's a grittiness to them as well as all the brilliant football, kind of a committed bunch you feel at the moment. So they're kind of a complete team. Like, they were awesome. And then Foden, Like that moment towards the end where he turns just so gracefully on the ball, swivels more so on the ball and gets that angle shot away, and really unlucky not to score that goal. That would have capped off the performance. Lequipe might have bumped him up to an 8 then, I think, Dan. he was phenomenal again.
Yeah, and your initial point there about City, definitely I would agree with. Like, there probably would have been a time where you would have associated City with sort of, and they've had a couple of them in Europe themselves, if you go back to maybe Monaco games and various times, sort of like chaotic enough, high-scoring, end-to-end ties, you know, with sort of loads of chances being given up, and they're almost trying to outscore teams, you know, and that's not really been the case this season with City. Like, it's not always necessarily been, they're good to watch, but it's not necessarily always thrill a minute in the sense that, like, you know, they're massively open. Mm. And I mean, that's why Diaz is getting all the praise, and that's why, you know, that's why generally it's the team with the best defense that, and, you know, the best work rate defensively that tends to win leagues. You know, it's certainly no coincidence. And that they've managed to probably adapt that to a knockout scenario as well. I mean, listen, they had their moments against Dortmund too. Mm. Like, they're not by no means flawless. And actually, I think in a one-off game, I don't think whoever's in the final is going to be intimidated by the prospect of facing them. But
no,
there is no doubt as well. There's a steeliness probably that wasn't, I mean, clearly it wasn't there last season, because they were miles off it. And this time round, they're far more efficient in terms of how their overall service they provide.
Mm. Not least Chelsea, I think, who really more than matched them in that FA Cup semi-final and contained them. And there is an organisation about Chelsea now and a focus. They all know what they're doing. Tuchel's really impressed me, I have to say. I mean, it's kind of hard to judge him at PSG for so many reasons, but I think everybody's come around to the fact that he's a brilliant manager. And Mason Mount should have put this game and this tie beyond Real Madrid. He was in one-on-one and just over the crossbar with the shot. He's been very good this evening, but he really should have scored there. So it's still 1-0 to Chelsea, 2-1 on aggregate, 55 minutes on the clock. Dan, we'll move on because there's lots to get to, and I want to get to it all. There is Europa League action tomorrow evening, obviously. So Arsenal, to a lesser extent, United certainly looking to make the final, Arsenal behind against Villarreal. And United well clear of Roma, you would think. I mean, it would be extraordinary if Chelsea see this through. Arsenal come back against Villarreal and United go through. And you've got the Champions League final and the Europa League final with four English sides. Like, even Man City are the ninth different English team to reach the Champions League final, which is three more than any other nation. Germans and Italians have six. So there is amazing strength in the English league at the moment. But anyway, I diverse. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer doing his press conference today, obviously ahead of the game. I have two clips for you. So the first one, I mean, this was the first time the media got to talk to Solskjaer since the protest. He has a tricky line to walk here, Dan. He's got the owners to his left, and he's got the fan base who he needs right behind him to his right. So here's what he had to say about the protests on Sunday.
It was a difficult day for us. Of course, we wanted to play. We wanted to beat Liverpool, for the fans even. We have to listen. We have to hear the fans' voice. It has to be it's everyone's right to protest. It has to be in a civilized manner, though. It has to be in a peaceful manner. And unfortunately, when you break in, when police officers get injured, scarred for life, that's too far. Of course, we want to listen. It has to be in a peaceful manner. It's important. Please voice your opinions. We know, as I've said, as a club, we need to communicate better. I can refer back to the apologies. They've all accepted it came out wrong and it was the wrong thing to do, which is a start. I know that for our fans, results are important. My job and my responsibility are the results. And we want to get back to winning trophies. We haven't won for a while.
That's Solskjaer. I think Dan probably taken relatively strong line against the breaking into the stadium and obviously what happened to that police officer. That was dreadful, you know, scarred for life and could have lost his sight. Like, that was really terrible. I think we all saw the pictures of him on Sunday. That was, so, you know, it's funny. If there's points of emphasis here, if everyone's kind of broadly on the same page that, you know, we have to listen to fans and equally we don't want scenes like we saw at Old Trafford, I would say Solskjaer was more on the ladder. He was more in the Graeme Souness camp, whereas maybe Sky on Sunday were more in the, yeah, okay, Dave, we get it. Yeah, no one wants the violence or the breaking into the stadium. But the fans have been heard here. They put down a marker. I think Solskjaer's gone more for the, well, we can't really have what we saw on Sunday point of emphasis.
No, but it's sort of a no-win press conference for him, really, that, you know, that situation in terms of what he said. And look, you know, by making the point in relation to the, as you said, you know, a policeman sort of being scarred for life. I mean, you put it like that. I mean, how can you possibly be seen to condone it in any way? You know, that's.
And to be fair on Sky, if I've given the wrong impression, nobody at all condoned it. Everyone condemned that. But it was more of a Dave Jones at the end of each kind of long answer about how the Glazers have to hear this and this is the fans speaking out. Dave Jones would kind of come in and say, but like, we are condemning this, aren't we? And then it was like, yeah, we're condemning it. But whereas Solskjaer's gone more the other way, I think, there.
Yeah. And listen, I mean, the thing about Solskjaer is like, I mean, it's a difficult one, as you said, because yeah. No matter what way you look at it, like, probably under a lot of other ownerships, he wouldn't be the manager of that club, you know. And at times along the way, other clubs probably would have shown him the door or responded to pressure to show him the door. So he's not suddenly going to align himself with the sort of the anti-Glazer, quite substantial faction, who, by the way, like, have very, very valid points that they raise. And, you know, people sort of simplistically linking it to sort of not winning trophies and stuff is obviously far, far more depth of feeling to it than that. And there's certainly, like, there is something in the broader point of fans maybe now seeing that they have a bit of a voice and stepping up their actions and thinking, yes, now is the time. You know, and I suppose part of it as well is this, and we're in a pandemic and everyone's mood is heightened in some respects, you know, and maybe that at times explains the severity of stuff. But as we watched Chelsea miss a great chance there to wrap it up. But that's like the bigger picture of it. But really, from Solskjaer's perspective, like, in a way, like, what more could he say?
Yeah,
there?
You know, I think he did about the right thing. He certainly condemned it strongly enough and emphasised. But I'm listening. I hear you. And in fact, as we'll hear a second clip here, he says that he's received a personal apology from the Glazers over the European Super League.
You know, I've been communicating with the owners. I've got an apology personally. They've apologised to the fans how this came out. I can't. I know that there has started communication between other individuals than me and the fans. And it, as I said, it is a difficult position to be in for me, this, because I've got to focus on the football. And it's I've always had a good relationship and they listen to me. And they do listen to the fans. And I'm sure they'll be... there'll be better communication coming.
So there we are. Chelsea have announced they're going to have fan representation on their board as well. I mean, this all feels a bit tokenistic, doesn't it? I don't think...
they're not going to be... I don't think
Roman's going to be turned to the fan representative saying, well, go on, you decide then. What do you think?
Yeah, like, who will we go for as manager? How will we price our... well, actually, you know, you never know. They might get involved, and that's how you sort of make the tokenistic role. Consult them a bit on maybe some supporter-related stuff, but yeah. I'm not sure they're going to be shaping club policy, to be fair.
No, like, for instance, I don't think Avram or Joel are going to ask the fans, what do you think about the dividend business? We're quite keen on continuing the dividends. What's your sense on that?
Yeah, we're thinking this might be good for the family business.
Yeah.
What do you think? I mean, come on, listen. We've all got jobs to do. We've all got mouths to feed here. Yeah. You know, you understand. You've got a family as well.
I heard Simon Jordan was on TalkSport this morning, obviously former chairman of Crystal Palace, and you know, he just kind of summed it up pretty neatly. He said, look, this is big boy business. This is how business is done. Leverage buyouts happen in business all the time. It's how most companies are bought, and this is grown up business, and unfortunately football is just coming into contact with it for the first time. And yeah, it's not nice, and they obviously have a social kind of aspect to them as well, community aspect, which means they probably should have been protected from this kind of thing. But you know, this is just the way of the world, everyone.
Well, no, I mean, listen, it's broadly true. I suppose the fact that, you know, it happened to Manchester United, though, you know, coming off the back of a couple of goals in decades or a decade and a half, that this sort of managed to sort of to happen to them, I suppose, at that point. But yeah, listen, the broader point, of course, is that the business of all sorts of takeovers of many businesses and many football clubs, it's not always, it's not like, you know, the old school stories you read of, like, you know, someone like this sort of, I don't know, this wealthy industrial figure in a town, like, coming in to buy the local football club and, you know, give jobs to everyone and, you know, have a real community sense of involvement and stuff. But you mentioned, like, there's potentially four Premier League clubs in the major European finals. Like, it's in the lifespan of the Premier League, it has become like a global business, you know, and, you know, it's subject to the rules of global business, you know, and the playing field abides by those rules. And these are the type of deals that you have. And yeah, not every takeover involves, you know, a Gulf state with so much money they don't know what to do with it. You know, just unable to almost cope with the wealth that they have and needing to actually find ways to engineer sponsorships to sort of prop up the fact of the spending that they're doing. You can go the other route and you get that type of American takeover. And yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah. Well, I guess if the four make it, you've got the Sheikh and his billions accused of sports washing. You've got the oligarch, and then you've got the leverage buyout crowd taking dividends out of the club. And then you've Stan Kroenke, I guess, just hanging on to it for the hell of it. I don't think he's taking huge dividends out, but obviously the capital appreciation is significant. So they're your Fab Four.
Yeah, my dilemma with those four would be trying to figure out who I want to lose more.
I know.
You know, like who do I, like, is there any way, like, this could be null and voided? I mean, it really is. Listen, it's obviously very good football to watch, you know, particularly the Champions League, potential Champions League final. But even if it's Madrid, I mean, really, like, I mean, there is no joy in this. Yeah. There is no good solution here. Individual tales of, you know, I love Kevin De Bruyne and certain players, and yeah, you know, fantastic. But yeah, really, it's actually horrible.
Yeah.
It's genuinely horrible. And I, if there was any way they could all lose, I'd totally endorse it.
Okay. Let's move on before clock comes against us. So League of Ireland, European Super League hijacked our plans to do a decent chat about where we are. We're now 9 games into the season. It's ticking along. Shamrock Rovers, top of the table. They lead by 2 points. They're on 23 points. They lead St. Pat's on 21. We have Sligo on 16. Dundalk, if you're wondering, 2 weeks on from the exits of Giovignoli and Shane Keegan, are sixth. They're on 10 points. So you would think well out of touching distance already of Shamrock Rovers. Waterford, bottom of the table. They're on 6 points after 9 games. And Dan, it would seem this evening, courtesy of mutual consent, according to the statement, Kevin Sheedy and Mike Newell have departed. This has been bubbling away. I feel like there were reports they'd gone a couple of weeks ago and then they weren't, and there was a sense of unrest about the whole thing. I don't think Sheedy's relationship with the media was overly brilliant. So, and as I speak, Kante has now just missed a one-on-one. Chelsea could rue this. They're missing one-on-ones every time I look up, so they'd want to score that second one because they're giving a sucker an even break here. So that was my sense of what's been going on at Waterford from afar. Give us the detailed situation.
From one blues to another. Yeah, I mean, now this has been coming, certainly. Like, 2 weeks ago, almost, just under 2 weeks ago, there was a day where they didn't take training, Sheedy and Mike Newell, that the players were out on the training pitch, and it ended up being the goalkeeping coach and the fitness coach doing the training. And there was speculation that day that they were gone, which was actually denied by the club. And, I mean, obviously, it wasn't true at that stage because they ended up back in training the next day and in charge for a couple more games. There's various unrest. Brian Murphy, their goalkeeper, you know, been around Ireland squads, long career in England, probably would be the highest paid player at the club, I would suggest, although no one there is earning very big money. But he's been frozen out completely in the last couple of weeks, which was a bit odd. For the last 2 games, they only named 3 substitutes on the bench, even though they've got an academy section there and young players. Sheedy came out sort of claiming, that they couldn't, you know, they wouldn't want to put young players on the bench because they wouldn't be protected by the referees in the league, which is a bit of a strange one because the days of the league being a choppers league where that stuff happens is sort of gone. Mm. And Mike Newell himself, you know, he was there for 9 games. He's assistant manager and he was sent off twice from the sideline. A fiery enough presence. So there was an awful lot going on there, and not a lot of it very good. But the overall sense, to be honest, was, and Waterford have gone this way with John Sheridan, who, to be fair, did a good job and left. But they've gone. You know, Lee Power, the owner, has gone with Kevin Sheedy, who'd never managed. You know, a legend in Irish football, and it can't be disrespectful to someone like that, but had never managed a team at senior level before in terms of his full-time job. Newell had more experience of that in England, but had been a bit of a fiery character and hadn't managed for some time. And the idea, I suppose, they could come in, listen to the pandemic, tough time to come into the country. They had no players and they had to bring in a load of lads on loan. So there was difficult circumstances there, but they didn't necessarily seem to be, I don't know, from what I heard, there was would have been some player concerns about maybe just the preparation for certain games and stuff. And I'm sure the managers would defend and say they knew what they were doing. They've been around the game for a long time. But just the sense of unrest was there. And in that sense, it's no surprise what's happened.
Okay. Elsewhere, Chris Forrester, I think he's fairly...
Yeah, this is what we're talking about.
Well-known player, really talented player, and he's been playing well for St. Pat's. And Stephen O'Donnell, obviously, is doing a very good job, it would seem. And he said, a happy footballer off the field makes for a happy one on it, is what Stevie O'Donnell said of Chris Forrester after a brilliant display down. I didn't see it, but a brilliant display in their win over Longford, by all accounts. And reading Forrester's quotes, quite interesting. So he returned home from Scotland in early 2019, citing personal issues and talking about winning battles with himself. So a lot of work's gone into that, working on myself, winning little battles with myself every day. He's 28 years of age now, and he's been over at Peterborough in the past as well, and Aberdeen. Really good player. He said, I don't want to make this about depression or anything, but it has been a journey. I'm here now. I'm ready to kick on. Winning little battles every day, that might sound mundane, but stuff around the house, taking up hobbies, reading, meditating, whatever it may be, focusing on yourself, not the things that you can't affect, which I found myself doing a lot. And he admits he probably wasn't physically right on his return 2 years ago, due to, it seems, his mental health at the time. He said, not being in the right physical shape. Yes, that was massively down to my mental state. I wasn't putting myself in positions where I was going to be the best player on the pitch. It's been a journey to get me where I am now. It's not something you can change overnight. It's a work in progress. So, well, good on him is kind of what jumps out, and seems to be going very well again and happy in himself and playing good football and still only 28.
Yeah. I mean, if people want to seek out the sort of a Pat's had a great camera angle, the roving reporter as such, for a goal he scored against Longford last week, the technique is genuinely top notch. Like, you have these players sometimes in the League of Ireland who they've come home and there's always that stench of like failure associated with that, which is wrong. Okay, it's just completely wrong. But listen, that's a perception that exists. But Chris Forrester is someone who didn't struggle in England because of his ability. You won't find anyone who says that. Or if they do, they just don't know what they're talking about. And like, there were other factors. Like, he had a very brief spell in Scotland, but really it was with Peterborough. And he did speak to Alan Cawley on his podcast recently, which is sort of a forerunner to those quotes there.
Right.
It was a sort of an extraordinary interview, really. Like Chris is a real natural street footballer, really talented player, but would have been very sort of painfully shy, he would say himself, when he was younger. And it probably played into some of his, you know, maybe mental health factors. He went away and he spoke on that podcast at length about his time in England. And some of it is sort of extraordinary, really, that you have a perception of what a footballer might be, you know, sort of brash or whatever, and flash. Like, for example, I don't like picking out anecdotes, and you can sense sort of patronising in speaking about it, and Chris actually articulated it very well. But, like, for example, a small thing. Like, he was over in England, and he didn't have any Wi-Fi in his apartment because he didn't really want to ask anyone about the hassle of getting it in to sort it out for him. And just every evening, he was over there on his own. He'd go to the local, golden discs or, like, some, and rent out a DVD every evening, and just go back to his apartment and watch it on his own. And that was it. He had a young kid at home that he was really missing. And he's just someone who probably wasn't equipped for being away at that stage of his life, to be honest. And then he had his own mental health issues that he's referred to there. And people may not remember, but Chris Forrester in his first 18 months at Peterborough was exceptionally good. Darren McAntony, he played against Chelsea in a TV game, was outstanding. Darren McAntony, the chairman, was talking about being worth 4 or 5 million. You know, there was proper clubs interested in him. But it seems like a lot of his confidence and other issues caught up with him, and his form plummeted. A close family member passed away. There was a lot of things that happened. And when Chris came home to St. Pat's initially, he was a shadow of himself as a player for those factors that you probably touch on there. He physically wasn't right and possibly was struggling. And under Stephen O'Donnell, he's managed to somehow coax Chris Forrester back close to where he is. And to be honest, like, Chris Forrester at his best, you know, will probably be one of the best players in the league. You know, like, there is no questions about his ability. Zero. Anyone who watches him play will see that clear as day. But he hasn't been happy. And I think he said himself in that interview, his main battle every day is trying to be happy. And, like, if football comes with that, brilliant. But, I mean, if you talk about players that are worth watching and players that are sort of, you know, worth the admission fee when people can pay and go to games, he'd be well up there. And Pats play Rovers on Saturday. Unfortunately, again, you know, closed doors games, so I can't say to people to go along and watch it. But it's going to be very interesting to see, because he has been one of the stories of the season, his resurgence.
Okay. Any sign, finally, of a new manager around Dundalkway?
No, that's not. Jim McGilton is the caretaker manager there. He's the sporting director who's technically charged with finding a new manager while currently acting as temporary manager. I went down to watch them play Longford on Monday. They were below par, really, for what they should be. But I get the sense that there's not an appointment coming in the next couple of days or anything like that. It might take a bit longer, but it's a big appointment, because 9 games is one series of games gone. It's like a quarter of the way into the season, and they're 13 points behind a Shamrock Rovers side that, by the way, it must be mentioned, like, they are now unbeaten in 31 games, which is the League of Ireland all-time record. So they're not like a team that's going to lose. You can't imagine them losing 4, 5, 6 games this season, put it that way.
So, oh, no, Dundalk are out of it already.
You would have thought so, yeah. You would have thought so, barring, you know, they'd need to beat Rovers 3 times, and a lot of other things would need to be going right at the club to even get into that position.
We'll take a short break. I know you wanted to touch on something Micheál Martin said last night about the League of Ireland academies, and Áine O'Gorman's going to join us as well. It's still 1-0 Chelsea. We're seeing a replay as I speak of a succession of 1-on-1 chances. Kai Havertz missed one. We're seeing now Mason Mount blasting one over the bar. There was the header, of course, which went off the crossbar. They're racking him up. It'll be a sorry tale if Chelsea don't win this tie, looking at those chances. But they are in real control at the moment. But still, 1-0 on the night, 2-1 on aggregate, 75 minutes on the clock.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
And now you welcome Max, 77 minutes on the clock. Chelsea 1-0 up against Real Madrid, 2-1 on aggregate. Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent still with me. Dan, on Micheál Martin's comments, I presume it's the academy point you want to touch on, is it? I have the quotes here if it is.
Yeah, no, I thought that was the most, football-wise, was the most interesting part of the chat, yeah.
Yeah, we didn't spend much time on this at all. In fact, there were 10 other things I just didn't get to with him. But this came up in the context, I suppose, of going after the World Cup in 2030. And we were talking about how we spend money generally, and I talked about, League of Ireland stadiums as opposed to trying to host this World Cup and, you know, hanging out with Boris Johnson and all that kind of stuff. And he said, well, it doesn't have to be one or the other. He said, governments have provided funding, but I think we should up it a bit in terms of the league itself, the current funding. Sporting expenditure isn't huge, yet the value is enormous. And I think the model of soccer has changed. It puts the League of Ireland in a real difficulty. And he talked about improving the stadiums, but then actually, and I didn't put it to him about the change in the academy system, because in fairness, there's a lot going on in his work life at the moment. I wasn't so sure he'd be on top of that, but in fairness, he was. He brought that up. Actually, I didn't bring up the academy with him. And then I explained the situation, you know, for the listeners, schoolboy clubs handing it over to the League of Ireland clubs, and they have to run the 13s, 15s, 17s, 19s national sides now, and money is going to be an issue. Sunday Business Post a while back, one quote suggested there could be a deficit of up to 40, 50, 60 grand over a given year to run the 4 teams. UEFA give 50 grand towards it, the FAI give 10 grand towards it, but then the League of Ireland clubs will have to make up the deficit, it seems. And on Taoiseach said, Dan, that the funding underpinning all this is difficult, and there's work to be done in the schoolboys league. Some of the academies have taken from the clubs in terms of players. He believes it's a case of the government, quote, stepping up to the plate, end quote. And I said to him, are you doing cold hard cash here? And he nodded in the affirmative. Yeah. Now, he didn't put a figure on it. He didn't put a timeline on it, but he did bring that up, and he did say cash, money to help the academies.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. And you know, recording the podcast I do with Johnny Ward today at LOI Central, we actually had Kevin McHugh on, who's the head of the Finn Harps Academy, and we were actually discussing the teacher's comments, and he actually laid out very well, just like, you know, the issues they face in terms of sort of finances, and the biggest issue they face is facilities and finances, and the two of them are interlinked. You know, he was talking about the number of teams they have, and because they don't have their own centre of excellence per se, their own facility that they own, they're spending a lot of time finding pitches here or there for the volume of teams that they have. And that actually, if they had some, you know, if they had some sort of financial security and support, that could allow them to concentrate on the more football development side of things. And I think that this is a very relevant point. And funny, Kevin McHugh, he's taken issue with some of the commentary in the debate. Like, he says that the League of Ireland clubs do have the expertise and the coaching ability to do a very good job, but what they don't have is the some of the finance and the facilities. And I think this has been touched on at various times, the general concept of, you know, how can you justify state funding for football? You know, you can't, like, you know, like for example, in the IRFU, like, can you justify state funding that just pays the wages of, like, the premium players to keep them in Ireland? I'm not sure about that, you know. And whereas if you have a situation at the moment where you have a sort of a, we have issues in terms of football, sending off, you know, players to England, generally, you know, lads, but I think in years to come, it's going to be girls as well, that we're sending them away at a sort of a really young age. And, you know, there's obviously questions about how prepared they are. And there's always been a discussion as to maybe really where the state could get involved here is if they were to fund the academies, if they were to fund structures that allow people to have a proper setup here for younger players, be it education, be it football education, whatever it might be. There's actually probably a social benefit for that as well too. There can actually be a benefit to, like, younger athletes, in the same way that on your chat there with the teacher, you spoke about Olympians, and I thought it was interesting, he was talking about, it's not about when they get to the top of the mountain, it's almost preparing them to get there. And I think that in some respects with football too here, that, like, we're not always serving ourselves best with the sort of with the funding that is available coming up the ranks. And as said, like, in the, to be fair, like, the League of Ireland has a bad reputation because over the years clubs get money and they spend it on first team wages and stuff like that, and stuff that it's impossible to justify it. But now that you have clubs that have to put out underage teams at academy level now, I think the idea, the concept of the state funding some of those academies in some way, I think it's a very worthy one. And I thought it was interesting that he's invited to comment, but obviously, you know, he's gone in a year, possibly, you know, unless something changes. So it's about the Department of Sport and those people probably to follow through in it. But there always has been whispers at various times that probably with the improved relationship between the FAI and government, they might be more open to it. And the FAI have made an appointment in the last couple of months, Will Clark, sort of to head up the League of Ireland Academies. So to oversee some work there. So maybe there's something that's possible, but I think obviously the debate would be, do we still have, you know, do you need to focus it to a smaller number of centres as opposed to 20 different ones? I think there's obviously, you know, there's different aspects to that debate.
We have Áine O'Gorman with us, PMENT, and of course Republic of Ireland International as well. Áine, how's things?
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Very good. Well. I know you're keeping an eye on this game. Chelsea want to stop missing these Chelsea want to stop missing these chances. There's only so many times you want to give Real Madrid a chance.
I know. I think they could have the game well wrapped up now and home and dry. But this is football. Look, 10 minutes or so to go and who knows what's going to happen.
We want to talk about the Champions League semi-finals at the weekend. But first, just worth mentioning, PMENT are top of the table. They're on 12 points to Wexford's 10, beat Treaty United at the weekend. A crucial second goal in there from an O'Gorman. So things are going all right thus far in the league. Wexford had a 5-0 win over Galway, so they're keeping pace.
Yeah, definitely. I think obviously Wexford's win over Galway probably stands out over the weekend, and Shelburne had a tough game against the Elora as well in Talca Park. So yeah, look, 4 wins from 4, but there's still a long way to go, and we keep plugging away. I wouldn't say we've hit the ground. I think there's a lot more of us come. There's a few more gears and stuff. Hopefully that will come over the week, but it's a results business at the end of the day.
The World Cup draw was made as well, I should touch on that. 2023, obviously, it would be great to get to Australia and New Zealand. It's still really tough to get out of Europe, even though the competition I was reading, it's been expanded now to 32 teams from 24. So Europe go from 8 to 12 teams. Basically, I mean, winning the group is difficult. Sweden and Finland are the two with Ireland. Ireland third seat. Sweden, Finland, Ireland third seat. Slovakia and Georgia in there as well. The Swedes have qualified for every tournament since the competition inception in 1991. Chelsea have scored, by the way, at last. Looks like Mason Mount. Okay, Chelsea are through. So the Swedes Swedes have got through to every tournament since 91. Finland, I was reading, have never qualified for the World Cup, but they've made four of the last five Euros. They topped their group for the Euros with Portugal and Scotland, had seven wins and a draw, so clearly in a good vein of form. So, not easy. What do you make of this draw?
Yeah, look, I think your top seed's always going to be difficult, and Sweden are obviously going to the Olympics this year. They're fifth in the world at the moment, so a really tough opposition as a top seed. Finland as the second seed as well, obviously topped their group and qualified for the Euros again. Another tough game, probably. Then we look down Slovakia, probably a tough fourth seed as well. But look, I think every World Cup qualifying campaign you go into is always going to be tough. But from our point of view, it's doable as well. And obviously, even if you get that second position, you still have to go through a rounds of playoffs.
Yeah. Is realistically the Euros the best chance, without being defeatist at the outset? Or maybe it's a crazy thing for you guys to even talk that way, especially at the start of a campaign, but is it really about absolutely making the Euros next time out, or is it about as difficult to make Euros as it is World Cup?
Yeah, look, like it's tough to make the Euros as well. I think even if we'd finished second in the last group, we still would have had to go into a playoff.
Yeah.
Ukraine went on to play Northern Ireland and Northern Ireland beat them, so they qualified for Euros, which is a massive, massive achievement for them as well. But look, I think we're just looking to make that step to qualify for a major tournament. So obviously the World Cups are our next goal, and we really have to learn from, I think, the last campaign and just winning them pressure games.
Because, I mean, Ireland generally ranked, what, 31st in the world, give or take? I think it's 31st, 34th at the moment, but it was 31st last year. And you look at Northern Ireland, 50th in the world, beating Ukraine 4-1. We know all about Ukraine, and they had loads of injuries as well, Northern Ireland. I mean, not that you needed any more disappointment about the whole thing, but I'd say you're kind of thinking to yourself, geez, look at these up the road, and we're more than a match for them.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I think it was a bit of a kick in the teeth, but can't take that away from them. And they obviously went into the group as fourth seeds, managed to get to a playoff, and put a lot of work and hard training in. 14 of their players are playing in the League of Northern Ireland at their home base, and I know they were training week in, week out, and
right.
They came together. They have some top class players and in centre mid and up front and some goal scorers. So look, credit where credit's due. They deserve to qualify, but I suppose from our point of view, it's frustrating that we haven't made that step yet.
Sorry, Dan, I think you were coming in there, were you?
Well, no, I was actually going to make a very similar point to that, right. Joe. I mean,
we're both trying to make you feel worse here.
I wasn't going to repeat it, but like, what about Finland's level? Because it does seem like on that probably they might be the key games in the group. I don't know. I know there's obviously other, like Slovakia and Georgia are in there too, but what about Finland's level? I mean, Sweden's pedigree is well known, but in terms of where their players play or what sort of standard they're at?
Yeah, like I think they've always been up there, and they've obviously qualified for a lot of European championships in the past, and we have had them in our group before, and we've beaten them before in friendly tournaments, and it just, when it came to the crunch game, I remember I can't quote the date right now, but we played them away in Finland, and they beat us in that crunch game. So it's learning to, I suppose, win them pressure situations, and I think we have the capability and the squad of players and the management team and the back end to go on and do that now.
On the Champions League front, Barcelona against Chelsea. So this is going to be free to the world on YouTube as much as anything. So it's a really good chance for people to watch this game. It's going to be on Sunday, May 16th. I know the semi-finals were at the weekend and you had a look at them. So Chelsea beat Bayern Munich and Barcelona beat PSG. This feels like it's starting now to get very competitive. Obviously, Lyon have been dominant for a long time. They won the last five Champions Leagues, but you've got Barcelona now starting to bubble away. You've got a lot of the English teams starting to bubble away. Like, I think this is just the second time an English team has been in the final. Arsenal got to European final in 07. So this is quite exciting, I would think, for the game to have the likes of Barcelona, Chelsea. I know Chelsea are doing brilliantly domestically this season as well. Taking this all very seriously and investing in the women's game.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's set up to be a really good game. Obviously, it's Chelsea's first time getting to a final. Barcelona were in a final in 2019 and lost to that Lyon team who've won the Champions League seven times now. So, and then they went on to be the PSG team that knocked Lyon out of competition. So it's been really, really tight and really competitive. But you can see now these clubs that they're investing in winning these trophies. Like, look at the way Chelsea have recruited Pernille Harder. They got Sam Kerr last year, and their squad has a lot of strength and depth. And obviously, they're still in the running for the league as well, with one game remaining there too. And then you look at Barcelona as well, the strength and depth. And even against PSG, they made some changes. Liga Martins, who didn't start in the quarterfinals, came on and scored the two goals. And you just see that they had that directness in their play when they needed it. And obviously, they're typical kind of Spanish possession-based team with really good quality and Hansen, Hermoso. So yeah, it's going to be a quality game to watch. And I've been watching all the games to date, so I'm really, really excited for this. Like, Chelsea are just so good on the counter-attack with Sam Kerr, Frank Kirby, Pernille Harder. It's frightening, and you wouldn't want to come up them as a defence. And then Barcelona are missing a player through suspension out of the back line too, so that will hurt them too. So, but then they have that little bit of extra experience as well. They played there before. They got to the last year they were knocked out by Wolfsburg, who got to the final against Lyon, and I think they were unfortunate to get knocked out in that game as well, and dominated and had a lot of chances. And now it's they've kind of changed the squad, and they can go more direct with the likes of Liga Martins and Ashuala if she's playing up front then, and getting behind teams too.
It was very striking how emotional Emma Hayes was, you know, just for Chelsea to reach this stage. She was interesting as well. She said when she saw Bayern had switched from 4-4-2 to 3-5-2, which had done well, I think, in the first leg, she was pretty happy with that and felt that would suit them. So that was her taking the game. But they were all incredibly emotional, the Chelsea players.
Yeah, I think you can see how much it means to them and how driven they are for that success. To get there, and they've invested and recruited to get to them to this point. You just have to even look at their bench. Like Beth Dignan, who's obviously been unfortunate with injuries and concussion this season, who was a player of the year last year, sits on the bench for the majority of the season. So that just shows the firepower they have. And Mielda did her cruciate ligament, the right back, earlier in the year, and Carter's came in and replaced, and you wouldn't even notice. And Eric, and the centre back came in behind Millie Bright, just came back in for the second leg, and it really I suppose strengthened them up and allowed Sophie England, the Welsh international, to go back into centre mid.
Who do you make favourites for the final, Anya? How close is this going to be?
It's really, really, really tough to call. Right. I think each game's been so close and fast paced for Chelsea, breaking forward and really taking their chances. And Hergeberg in goal for Chelsea has been outstanding, and particularly in the Wolfsburg game. I think she stood out and made some amazing saves just to keep them in the game at the key moments. So, for me, it's really, really tough to call. I think if Barcelona can take their chances, they might slightly edge it with experience. But now Emma Hayes will have them well set up and ready to go and use their squad accordingly.
Yeah. And just a last one, I'm curious. On Lyon, these five wins in a row, and as you said, seven European wins in total. Of this current era, these five wins, has this been the same core group and this is like an end of an era feel, or are Lyon as good as ever and they've just got a bunch of new players who'll kick on and they'll be there or thereabouts in the coming years?
Yeah, do you know what? I think it just shows the progress in other countries and how they've invested. Like, look where the Women's Super League is now in England. I think that's going to become the dominant force in women's football. Especially obviously with the TV deal with Sky Sports and BBC that they have coming in next year. And I think they've obviously attracted a lot of American internationals this year, and I think it's gone from strength to strength. And likewise, maybe in Barcelona it's slightly different. They're 14 points ahead at the top of the league, and they still have four games in hand as well, so that just shows their dominance. And I suppose that can be a positive and negative going into a crunch game and a one-off final as well. And it's different over two legs sometimes. I think usually the best team comes out over the two legs, but anything can happen in a one-off game, and really, really exciting, and hopefully it's a good one.
Yeah, Well, it's on May 16th. It's going to be on YouTube as well as BT and various other channels. So I'd say a lot of people find a way of watching that. Anya, thanks a mil.
No worries, Joe.
Cheers. Anya Gorman there of Piemont and Republic of Ireland. It's about to go full-time. Chelsea 2-0 winners in the night, 3-1 on aggregate. Dan McDonald, we are pretty much done for this evening. Thank you.
We are. Look forward to the romance of City-Chelsea, Joe. May 29th. Football is the only winner.
It is. All right, that's Dan McDonald for this evening. Back in one sec. Chelsea about to go through the Champions League final.